Well, welcome. As I mentioned last week, that for the end of the Sunday school semester, if we can call it that, we're going to look each Sunday at a different Bible book with the idea of how to teach through it. And so, whether it's for your own study, but if you ever get an opportunity to lead a Bible study, have a neighbor that wants to learn the Bible, and you want some material how to teach it, maybe your own children or any other setting. These are opportunities where, if you keep these notes, we'll go through the outline of how to teach through a book of the Bible. So we'll do some New Testament, then we'll do some Old Testament, and that'll bring us to the end of the before the summer break. So this morning it's 1 Corinthians. You may remember a couple years ago we went through 2 Corinthians in the service, but we never did 1 Corinthians. So let's go through the background a bit. The date, somewhere between 53 and 55 AD. And it was at the end of Paul's 3-year missionary, his third missionary journey. He spent 3 years in Ephesus, which is in Asia Minor. Now, the reason Paul wrote 1 Corinthians is he planted that church, he pastored there for a while, he moved on, and people would travel because people back then for business traveled all over, Christians, and some of them would come see him wherever he was, and they would report what's going on in the church that he started. But also, he would receive letters of the same. And in those letters, either he was hearing about problems in the church, or the Christians had questions about areas they didn't understand. Now, that's comforting for any pastor, because if an apostle spends a year and a half somewhere teaching, and as soon as he leaves, they have a lot of questions about doctrine, it shows that we all learn slowly. And so Paul is writing 1 Corinthians in response to these reports and these letters from people in the church. Now, it's likely Corinth grew to a fairly large church. We're not talking about one house, but they probably met in different houses throughout the city. So the church in Corinth means the Christians that are gathering in different churches in Corinth. Now, there are many types of believers there. There were intellectual Greeks. Paul addresses them in the book. Roman patrons, those are wealthy people who sponsored other people. Socially elite, you had the rich with very large homes. That comes out in 1 Corinthians. You had God-fearing Gentiles, which were Gentiles who had basically become Jewish. And you had some Jewish believers also. And then a large number of slaves. So you had a real dichotomy between the rich and the poor all in the church there. Corinth itself was demolished in 146 BC. And then Julius Caesar built a new city in its place there in 44 BC. It became a very prominent city because of its location. It was a port city, a very wealthy port city. Around the time of Paul, about 100,000 people. It was on an isthmus that connected the Greek peninsula to the mainland. And so it was a place where the boats coming from the sea would stop, as well as if you wanted to land there and walk all the way up to Rome through Europe. So it was a very central location. Because of that, you can imagine that was a place where the tradesmen would stop. It was a very known for a very sinful place. It was known not only as a trade center, but for its sexual immorality. It was famous for its sexual immorality. Even the non-Christian Roman moralists of the day would condemn Corinth in their writings. Sort of like we would think of maybe Las Vegas today. What goes on in Las Vegas? Well, we know. And so it was also a military center. It was a Roman colony, which meant that when the Roman soldiers would retire, they would be sent there and given land. And also, it was governed straight from Rome. Sometimes the cities had their own governments. Rome sort of backed off. As long as they weren't rebellious, they were allowed to have their own governments. But this was a Roman colony. So you would have Roman soldiers marching around, and they're very proud of that. And so it was a city where the cultures of the East and the West met. It hosted the biannual Isthmian Games, sort of second to the Olympic Games, very famous. And it was the home, as you can imagine, of very many pagan temples. Now, in the early church fathers, that's what ECF means in your notes there. It was 1 Corinthians was quoted more than any other book of Paul, which means they held it in a very important place. Acts 18, through a vision, the Lord revealed to Paul to go to Macedonia, where Corinth is, and that many would believe in the Lord in that city, which obviously happened. And there would be an open door there for Paul, that even though there would be opposition, the opposition would not defeat him, which is what happened. Now, Paul's strategy in Corinth was like every city. He would start preaching in the synagogue as a visiting rabbi would be allowed to. Once they realized what he was preaching, they would kick him out. And then he would start his Gentile ministry in the city. He tended to plant churches in major cities, and over time, those churches would plant other churches in surrounding areas. So that's the background of 1 Corinthians. Any comments or questions before we look at the outline? So let's look then at the outline. No questions or comments? Yeah, you're all good? You came ready to go, didn't you? Okay. So let's look at the outline. The outline of Corinthians is easy, like the outline of Romans we looked at last week. It's very logical. If you're going to teach through it, you can see that it outlines itself. Not all Bible books outline themselves, but 1 Corinthians is one of those that does. You have the introduction, the greeting, and then the thanksgiving that Paul was known for. And then from chapter 1:10 to 6:20, you have the reported problems going on at Corinth. He deals with each of the issues he's heard about one at a time. So the first one is factions within the church. Notice how many chapters are devoted to this one issue. So if Paul's going to start with this and he devotes four chapters to it, what does that tell you? It's a pretty serious issue when there are factions and divisions in the church. And what were the factions about? Do you remember? Well, what did they revolve around? Say it again. Okay, competing for attention. What did they each, how did they pick sides? Based on what? Okay, that's true. There were some rich and poor. What else? Yeah, it was based on who their favorite teacher was. Remember that? I am of Paul, I am of Apollos, I am of Peter. The spiritual ones, I'm only of Christ, which he was still criticizing that. So everybody picked their favorite and they divided over their favorite teacher. And so he deals with that. And then he goes on to the shocking immorality in the church of the one man who was involved in shocking immorality in chapter 5, and that man needs to be dealt with. Because he's had much time to repent, and if everyone knew about it, then it's not like he's hiding it. The whole church knew what he was doing. So Paul deals with that. Christian lawsuits in chapter 6. This is what we would call more small claims court. These are not criminal cases that would be held differently, but if you had an argument with someone in the church, let's say you had lent them money, and they weren't paying you back. They were taking them to the local court, what we would call the local small claims court, which would be right out in public in the city square. And Paul says, well, can't you handle your own disagreements? together? Do you have to bring all this before the world? And wouldn't it be better to suffer loss than to embarrass the gospel like this? And so Paul deals with that in chapter 6. And then in chapter 6, the end of it, Christian freedom limited by love and purity. Some of them were saying with their bodies they can do whatever they want. Paul says no and explains that. So that's when he deals with all the different problems in the church. The second part, starting in chapter 7, deals with questions they themselves had. And so the chapter 7 is about human sexuality. They had questions on abstaining from sexual relations in marriage because they thought that was the spiritual thing to do. So he answers that. Divorce, even among Christians, because that was they were having sort of an aesthetic almost a monkish view of marriage, where it's better to be single, better not to have relations. And so Paul deals with divorce. And then in chapters 11 and through 14, he deals with the gifts of the Spirit. What was the issue in Corinth? What did they think about the gifts of the Spirit? Right, so those who thought they were superior Christians because they had certain gifts were showing off their gifts and not using the gifts to edify others, but to gain a sort of status within the church. So he has to correct them on the use of gifts, what they're for, which one, how God views importance versus they, how they are. And that's that whole section towards the end. And then he ends with questions of eschatology. They had questions about the resurrection of the body. What does that look like? Does that even happen physically? So he addresses that all throughout chapter 15. And then chapter 16, he closes with a question about the contribution for the poor Christians in Jerusalem that he was collecting. And then concluding remarks, Paul and his fellow ministers, their travel plans, and final exhortations and greetings. So if you want to teach through 1 Corinthians, like I said, you can really go subject by subject and stay with the flow of the book. Any questions on the outline? Okay. We're going to be done with an entire book in 20 minutes, if the way we're going. All right, let's do the, let's look at really what's going on. What's the problem in Corinth? And Isaac actually just mentioned this in his answer. The problem was self-promotion. If you go to ancient Corinth today, if you go there to where the site is of Corinth, you'll find inscriptions written by rich people praising themselves. So if they did something, if they contributed something, if they built something, the inscription will say, on this date, I, give your name, contributed this much to this site. And they themselves had that put up. Now, we would never do that, right? I mean, Nick, you're working on the classrooms, right? Getting those fixed up. Can you imagine Nick putting up a big sign? I, Nick Gordon, fix these classrooms. In January 8th. Yeah, you want to do that? Gordon Hall? Yes. I mean, if you did that and we all walked by and saw, we would be, what in the world? But that was common in Corinth because it was a place where you were supposed to promote yourself. It was a place where your status meant everything. So even today, you can still see those inscriptions to understand the way people thought, the value system of that city. And so with that, what's what we call an over-realized eschatology. Another way to say that is, well, we're already in God's kingdom. The heavenly world is here, so we shouldn't be enjoying glory now. It was a theology of success and glory, not of suffering in this age. They expected a lot of respect from the world. They expected success in their lives because they were Christians. And so it was an over-realized eschatology. Instead of waiting for the second coming, they thought we should have everything now. So if you understand that, you can understand the unity of all these problems, because really it's one problem revealing itself in a lot of different issues. For example, for the factions, what was the argument? Who was the best leader? Some said Paul, some said Peter, some said John MacArthur. I'm just saying how people are today, right? There's the one guy that can't do wrong. And so that who was the best was the way they thought. That was a question everybody wanted to know. Preaching, who was the most impressive? Why were they struggling with the Apostle Paul? Right, he was not a professional rhetorician who was flowery in his speech. You could draw great crowds. He was, from our perspective, or from their perspective, boring. Because what did he always talk about? The gospel, Christ and him crucified. He wasn't talking about success in this world, how to 10 steps to have the best, whatever, your best life now, right? And so Paul had to explain, it's the foolishness of the cross that is the power of God. Remember that verse? Yes, and the foolishness of preaching is that God uses the simple gospel to save and sanctify his people. Money, who is the most respected? Corinth was the one city where Paul chose to do manual labor in the mornings and then ministry in the afternoon. When he moves on, we find out he doesn't keep doing that. So why did he do it in Corinth? Why did he become a tent maker in the morning? And everywhere else, he was provided for full time. Because in Corinth, you had a system, the patron system. And that is, when you were a speaker, you attached yourself to a rich patron who would, you would live in his house and he would support you. But you're kind of his, you know, he's sponsoring you. Have you ever been at a church where there's only one person because he's wealthy or she's wealthy and they give, and that's the only person who gives pretty much, and everybody gets a sense it's their church? You ever seen that before, anyone? Few of you have? Well, that's not a good situation, is it? That's what Paul was trying to avoid. Paul knew if he was supported by one of these patrons, then the patron would be looked upon as it's his church. And so Paul didn't want to be an offense to the poor. And so he worked. Now, that was an embarrassment to the wealthy, because in the Jewish world, manual labor was highly regarded. Most of the Jewish rabbis, they did something around the house, farm, worked. But in the Greek world, manual labor was what? It was despised. Who is it for? Slaves. If you were free and you had money, you didn't work. You had other people work for you. They did the manual labor. So for their beloved apostle to be doing manual labor, they were embarrassed. And Paul has to address that. Again, it's about their expectations in this life for success and value and respect. Even the spiritual gifts, it was all about who's the most important. Who in the church had the highest status? Would the ones who spoke in tongues? What about who used prophecy? Well, what about? So Paul has to correct that. Sexual immorality and divorce. Who's the most spiritual? Those who are married or those who are single? That was really the issue. And so Paul has to address this whole mindset they have of who's the most. It's not even a Christian mindset. The age of the Spirit. Why do we even need a bodily resurrection? Because we're already filled with the Spirit. We'll just sort of continue on this with the getting rid of these bodies. The age of blessings. If there's a disagreement with a fellow Christian, I want it resolved now and I want to win. Even if we bring them to court before the unbelievers, I expect to have my way and win and not lose anything. The values of Corinth. And then, of course, Paul's suffering. How could Paul be a genuine apostle if he's always suffering? Where is the evidence of God's blessing on this guy? The guy's a mess. He goes from one thing to another, whether physically, and he would have looked like a mess. Remember we talked about as many times as he's been stoned and beat, he would not have been pretty to look at. So he wasn't the guy you'd normally put out in front and say, you're our guy to preach. So Paul's suffering raised the question of, what does it mean to be a Christian in this age with God's blessing? How does that look? Now, that brings us to our conclusion. The unity of Paul's answers is always the cross. Paul always points them back to the cross. And so he teaches them that we suffer now, even in this Christian life, and we're resurrected later. We're glorified later, just like Christ. We follow the pattern of the cross. Christ was not respected when he was a man on this earth. He was disregarded. He was disrespected. He was put on a cross. We should not expect anything better in this life. We follow that pattern. The cross becomes our pattern. We love others instead of demanding our rights, 1 Corinthians 8. We love others the way Christ loved us by giving himself for us on the cross. We're willing to give up some freedoms if that freedom at the time means we hurt a brother's or sister's conscience. The foolishness of the cross is our message. And so it's not very interesting to the one that does not want to be forgiven and be right with God. If they want success in this life, our message is foolish. But that's okay. It's not going to draw a lot of people the way they expected. The foolishness of the cross. And then he ends with the order of resurrection. Now, think of 1 Corinthians 15. What does it say? Our body dies in, do you remember? Weakness, but it's raised in glory or strength. Even the order he has to correct. And so following Christ in his cross bearing becomes the theme of all the answers. Now there are two, last week we looked at Romans and then we looked at the problem passages. We don't have time to get into them this week, so we're going to do it next week. The two major questions from 1 Corinthians are divorce. In 1 Corinthians 7, we're going to talk about that next week. Some of you know I've written a book on that, so we'll talk about a little of that next week. But also tongues. Let's talk about what were tongues. How did they work? What was the problem? Why are there no more tongues? And so tongues and prophecy and interpretations. We're going to unfold 1 Corinthians 14 next week so you can see, because some of that language is somewhat difficult, the way it translates from the Greek to eventually to the English. I had commentaries last week listed and I forgot to mention them. But on the notes last week, the best, what I think are the best Romans commentaries I had on there. And that was, it was a Moo. Doug Moo is like the standard one. And then Hodge, Charles Hodge. The third one was a Lutheran guy, Ningren. He's great. He looks at it from an overview. Romans. Well, the two that probably the best in 1 Corinthians, if you want to buy commentaries, are Gordon Fee. Now, Gordon Fee, when you get to tongues, is not the best because he's charismatic. So he obviously takes a different position. But everything else, pretty much, he's great on in the whole book of 1 Corinthians. And then Thistleton. You may not be familiar with that name, but he has probably the best commentary out there on 1 Corinthians. It is somewhat scholarly, but you can, you know, ignore the Greek if you're not familiar. But almost all of it you can get. And so that's 1 Corinthians. Let's any thoughts or questions? I don't plan on more because you're usually so talkative, but you're so quiet today. So yes. Correct. Yeah, Paul sometimes sent Timothy or Titus after he left to be at these places, but they still had a mess. And sometimes they didn't respect them like they respected Paul when he first arrived. And Paul had more credentials from an earthly standpoint. You know, Christ himself had appeared to him. And he was a Pharisee, a rabbi. Yeah, it's really important to know the value system of the people, because it makes sense why they are the way they are. Corinth was a place where you could go from lower class to upper class. Usually in the ancient world, you are what you're born with, as far as class. Corinth, it was just a wealthy city with lots of opportunity. So you could make something of yourself there. And so value and status was everything. Not unlike our times, correct? Though we don't as blatantly self-promote the way they did. And that was considered a positive thing. You wouldn't question it. Isaac and then Rachel. Yeah, it's one of his earliest, though his prison epistles were early also. But you're right. The fact that it's so early does explain. I mean, most, even the early prison epistles, most of them don't even mention tongues. Like Galatians doesn't mention tongues at all. Yes, Val. Yes. Yeah, think of Israel today and Greece on a map. And Corinth is in Greece. Yes, Ken. Rachel, did you answer yet? Oh. Say it a little louder. That's true. I guess self-promotion, sort of blatant, is I considered okay now, huh? Yeah, I haven't thought of that. Ken? Oh, yeah, we could add head coverings. Just a couple points. First, and we can go there, but when Paul deals with head coverings, he's only dealing with the women who were praying or prophesying in the church. Those were the ones he deals with head coverings. So whatever your view of head coverings, it really didn't apply to all the women. It was the women who were doing a certain thing. And so you just can't take that, you know, take a side and then say that applies directly today. The other thing about head coverings would be that, I was going to say two things. Well, one, Paul's always concerned that we're not an offense in the culture we're in. And so something about that culture, women were expected to wear head coverings in certain instances, or else people thought certain things of them. Paul is saying that we are concerned with these things, not to bring shame upon Christ. That would only apply, the principle would be whatever culture you're in. So today it wouldn't really make sense. It's in our culture, it wouldn't make any statement. So Paul is dealing with an issue back then that he wants us to remember. We're still in this world. We do still have unbelievers watching us, and we are to care about that. The third thing is escaping my mind. Go ahead. Yeah, let's do that next week, just because there's just not enough time to address that. Yes. Yeah, well, let's add that next week then, because that's considered one of the most difficult passages in the entire New Testament. No, yeah, well, that is too. That's 1529. That's the Mormons use that, by the way, to baptize for dead people. You're familiar with that. That's considered the most obscure text in the entire Bible, because no one knows what it means. That's a whole maybe we'll take 2 weeks on 1 Corinthians. Yes. What do you mean? Yeah, and the only thing I can say as you think about telling women to be silent, he has just told them if they're going to pray or prophesy, wear a head covering. So we know he doesn't mean you can't speak in church. So we have to look consistently. What would it mean? What is that word silent? That might not even be the best translation, but we'll look at that. But he's just regulated how they should be doing that. So Paul can't contradict himself like that. Yes. Right. Right. Anything that, if the world in general thinks something is really offensive or sinful, we don't purposely flaunt it or do it because we know we have the freedom. Paul is arguing against that idea, that we are to be very, we're to think about what unbelievers think and not purposely offend them. Yeah, I mean, if you live in India, you wouldn't wear a t-shirt with a cow. Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't purposely offend them. Now, do you have the right to wear a t-shirt with a cow? Yeah, I mean, you have the right. But is that, would you do that as a Christian? I wouldn't be very smart, right? I remember when I went to, I thought this was really silly, I still do, but when I was a youth pastor, I moved up to the San Francisco area, but everybody there was a 49er fan. And I grew up a huge Vikings fan. I know. So the pastor actually told me, if you really want to get in with the youth, change your allegiances from the Vikings to the Niners. And I said, I can't. I can't because I hated the Niners. But I said, hey, that would be, I mean, they would see right through that, you know. I mean, that was a really silly example of being care about the culture. But there are other ways it's not silly, obviously. Then never mind, go ahead. Yeah, thanks for, I forgot to add that. Let's close on this point. The Lord's Supper, the problem was the rich were actually gathering and partaking before the poor could get there. You have to imagine the slaves couldn't just get off when they wanted from work, right? So you had to wait for a certain time that you were done with your work. Well, the rich, they would actually partake of the supper. And then the poor would come later and they would be, back then the rich ate inside and the poor ate at like an atrium outside. So they were actually eating at two different times, two different places based on their money. And that's where Paul says, you're taking the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner. You're dividing the church between rich and poor. Why don't you wait? He actually tells them, wait till everyone can get there. So again, the value system, the rich thought, this is what we do. They brought the Corinthian value system. This is how we eat, right into the church. And Paul says, we don't do that in the body of Christ. This is the way the world works. But we don't do that here. So again, the value system came right into the church, which shows us that we should be very careful of condemning Christians in the past when we know they've done that. Because then we're condemning ourselves. In other words, we're so engulfed in our value system and culture, we sometimes aren't the best people even to see it. So 500 years from now, Christians may be looking back at our day and saying, you know what those Christians did in the United States in the 21st century? They did this. They're like, didn't they realize how wrong that was? Nope. And so even though it is wrong, we sometimes don't always see it. Can you imagine like 1,000 years from now them saying, you know, Christians in those days, they couldn't even wake up without taking a drug called caffeine. They couldn't even start their day without this drug. I mean, yeah, that's just a funny example, but we don't question it. It's just the way we do things. But maybe they would look at it from another day. Man, all the Christians were drug addicts back then. You know, what was that like? And so we learn this from Corinth that they needed to be instructed and corrected, and Paul did, but it's easy to do. All right, well, let's close, and then next week we'll get into the difficult passages, or maybe the next 2 weeks. Let's pray.